I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. This is our monthly Countercurrents Book Club. And today, our guest of honor is Jason Kessler, who is going to be speaking to us about his new book, which is called Charlottesville and the Death of Free Speech. Jason, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And we have two panelists on the program today, both of whom have reviewed Jason's book for Countercurrents. And the first is Anne Wilson-Smith. Anne, welcome.
Hi.
And the other is a frequent guest who is F. Roger Devlin. Roger, welcome back.
Hi, thank you. My review was also cross-posted on VDare, by the way.
Good. Very good. So, Anne, it's a special pleasure to have you for the first time on Countercurrents Radio. I hope this will be the first of many. Okay. And I would just like to begin by asking Jason briefly to give a little bit of background on why you wrote the book. So there's a whole bunch of background in the book on Charlottesville, but the book itself has a story. So maybe you could give us a little background on why you decided to write this book.
Well, in the last year, I really got back into reading other people's stuff, especially history, for really the first time in my life, particularly revisionist history. So that's stuff that we read in our circles where we're calling into question mainstream historical accounts of events, whether that's World War I, World War II, anything. And I thought how that applied to my life and to the event that I took part in, which was a major historical event. And that was the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, which I was the permit holder for. And I thought there was so much that I still had to say. I wasn't really able to give my side during the various court cases that took place after the event. And I had all this evidence that I wanted to make sure entered the public record. And I wanted a primary source document detailing my experience with the event so that at some point in the future, when historians are ready to look back at this event without some of the political correctness that's involved now, which is totally silencing the permitted protesters' side of the account, that they will have something from the organizer who went to all the meetings with police, who saw all the stuff with Antifa. And I'd been researching this stuff for 6 or 7 years. So there really was nobody better to go ahead and write it at this time.
I remember your blogging away and also writing articles at VDare, just detailing so much information that you were gathering about the opposition, the people who were there at the Unite the Right, the machinations against the rally, all the post-Unite the Right drama, the lawsuits and stuff like that. So yes, you've been an absolute bulldog, just sort of not letting this go ever since 2017. So absolutely, I can see why you would be the perfect person to write this book. I want to just bring in our panelists and just we'll just have a couple of panel questions, and then I think this will just sort of flow naturally. And I want to go first to Anne, and then we'll go to Roger. Can you tell us what you thought was best about this narrative, best about Jason's treatment? You've written a book yourself on Charlottesville, Anne, so you're especially qualified to speak on this issue.
Yes, well, there are two things that I thought were important in Jason's book. One is that it put it into a broad perspective as far as looking at the free speech issues, looking at the monument destruction. It's a very important political point, and it was such a pivotal event, and most people don't really realize it. People comment about Charlottesville all the time, but they really just look at the highlights of the rally, and they don't like step back and take a view of what it really meant with turning point in American history. And so he puts it in that context. And I thought that is really important. And the other thing is that there's a lot of research and detail that has not been publicly presented before, as far as what exactly went on behind the scenes, as far as some of the details of what the Antifa were up to and things like that. There's just so much information that the general public's not aware of. And so I thought that putting that into document that is really important.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Roger, what are your thoughts about the highlights of this book? What did you find most valuable about it?
I believe that one of the main sources was several years worth of FOIA requests on the part of Jason, you know, stuff that has not been widely made known. And yes, he's got a lot. He's got an inside perspective on his negotiations with the city authorities and documents all their broken promises very well. In some cases, even manages to correct the Heafy report, which otherwise is a very good development for our side, a relatively fair account of what happened. But it could not have been, this book could not have been written the day after the rally. Evidence takes a while to come out. And so I congratulate you, Jason, for waiting a little while, for being patient and putting all of this information between two covers.
Thank you. Yeah, I sort of didn't have any choice because we were under assault by these powerful Jewish attorneys from New York for like 6 years. And so I was fighting tooth and nail just to be able to tell the story in court. And then the rug got pulled out for me by my own attorney. I didn't get to present any of my evidence. I didn't get to testify. So all that stuff is ready to be told now. And you're right. I mean, there's like the Freedom of Information Act requests. I also filed numerous lawsuits against the city and uncovered stuff that wasn't in the Heafy report. The Heafy report, which was created after the event, details how the police chief destroyed text messages to cover up his conduct during the rally. And we'll never know what was in those text messages. But through my lawsuits, I found out that the head of the Charlottesville government, the city manager, Maurice Jones, also wiped his phone with all of the text messages. So you're seeing a pattern of very shady, possibly criminal behavior that for political reasons, nobody's going to prosecute. And the only way you're going to know about some of this stuff is through my research.
Right. Wasn't some of your evidence ruled out of court for getting there a day late or something? What was that story?
Well, the problem was, is, you know, I was conducting research for years. And I kept turning it over to my attorney over and over. And he kept saying, well, we need it in a different format. This isn't going to be admissible. And then I'd work my butt off and get it in that format. Then later, oh no, I've decided that this won't work. Do it in this format. And then in the end, he didn't even turn anything over to the attorney. So we didn't get anything in. The only stuff that I got to use was stuff that other people had submitted. And we were the ones who were paying attorneys. I mean, these guys were total bums.
One thing I really liked about the book is putting it in the context of what came later. And looking back on it, it is sort of a turning point. I remember Countercurrents being deplatformed from a number of services in the aftermath of Charlottesville. I think that's when we lost PayPal, finally. Or was it Stripe? I can't remember. There have been so many businesses that have thrown away my business over the years for political reasons. They all sort of blur together. But
same thing happened with Peter at VDare and with other people who had nothing to do with organizing the event.
Yeah, absolutely. It was just an excuse.
As an excuse for a purge. Yeah, yeah. It was the occasion for a purge.
Yeah. These moral panics make it very, very easy for the left to just get these institutions, these nervous institutions, to pull the plug on a lot of perfectly innocent parties. And that definitely happened. It caused a great split in the broader white nationalist sphere after it was over. There was a great split against people reacting against public demonstrations and marches, things like that. There was a continuation of some of these demonstrations and marches later in the year and on into, I think, around the beginning of 2018. And then we had the great optics war that happened within our ranks. It was sort of simmering since Charlottesville. And it's caused a lot of changes in the strategy of the movement, I think, a lot of soul searching. And we really saw the regime with its mask off. I think a lot of people were very naive going into this about rule of law and freedom of speech and so forth. Jason, do you want to comment a little bit about how disillusioning this was for you and for other people?
Well, it was very hard. I mean, on a personal level, I mean, I don't think anybody could really understand what it's like. I mean, there's been some people probably even listening to that who've been through the fire and might have a piece of it. But, you know, to see your whole life fall apart, like I would have expected in that situation when you're under attack that all of your comrades would leap to your side, but the alt-right turned on me. They all started attacking me. I'm like, who are my friends right now, you know? And mentally, I was not in a good place. I was, you know, I was drinking, I was taking sleeping pills to be able to sleep, and it screwed me up. And years later, you know, I'm better than I've ever been, really, just because of how I've reacted to it since, where I've said, you know, well, either you can lay down and die or you can become stronger from this and try to prove all these people who have so much negative things to say about you wrong. But politically, yeah, that there was also that element, you know, just that people on our side and in the broader conservative movement, they just didn't learn anything from Charlottesville, which is why January 6th happened. All of these people just like turned on one another and thought about saving their own asses. I think the whole optics war was part of that. I think you had all these Machiavellis like Nick Fuentes who saw the fall of the alt-right is their opportunity for ascension. So you have all these people that are kind of like adjacent to white nationalism, but aren't maybe really white nationalists. They're like Catholic nationalists or various other things. And they never stand up for the people in Charlottesville. They have no idea what happened in Charlottesville. They're as clueless as the mainstream people. They don't know that we had a permit. They don't know Antifa attacked us. They don't know anything about it. And that's a shame, because what I've been telling people is, in order to have a basic literacy about what goes on in white nationalist strategy and what it's like to organize and all the problems you're going to encounter, you have to read this book. Because even if you think, oh, Charlottesville is just terrible, you know, you cannot learn unless you understand something. If you don't understand something, you're going to do like Fuentes and the others and just run into a January 6th.
Yeah, it strikes me as a great example of lack of solidarity. People on the right looked at the Charlottesville protesters, and they just thought, disavow. We you know, those are those people. They're bad people. We're good people. We're going to disavow that. We'll get by. The establishment surely wouldn't do anything like this to us. And it proved to be very naive. It proved very naive as we got into the 2020 election and found that, indeed, the president of the United States can be deplatformed from social media. And the treatment of the J6 people, all the lawfare against Trump since he had the election stolen from him, all of this was basically tried out in the aftermath of Charlottesville. And I think that that's a very important point that we have to understand. The left revved up a whole apparatus of repression in the aftermath of Charlottesville.
And there were people warning at the time that if you don't stop it here, if you don't stand with the people who are a little more on the fringe, it's going to keep coming for, and it's going to keep, and it's going eventually it's going to reach the mainstream. And you know, you need to stand for free speech, whether you like the people using it or not.
One of the things that my book does that I don't think anybody else's perspective could possibly have is showing what happened in Charlottesville before the rally, because they always say, well, none of them are from here. They're all from out of town. I lived in Charlottesville, and I saw that it wasn't just the aftermath of Charlottesville that where this future strategy of the left was gestating. It was happening before that, before you had like terms like cancel culture and cancel mobs. They were doing that to me when I had political meetings with other nationalists or conservatives, Proud Boys, things like that. And they would come and they would try to get us kicked out of businesses and deplatformed and all of the stuff with the removal of statues. I mean, that started in, I mean, it didn't start in Charlottesville. It was happening in other places like New Orleans. And I talk about that in the book too, but Charlottesville is really when it became a national issue that everybody talked about. And now even today you see, like, it's one of the go-to expressions of left-wing extremism. If they're doing a protest about anything, it can be about Palestine. They're still going to, you know, deface a monument to a white man just because it's there.
Right. And you are in South Carolina.
Yes.
Is that correct? And of course, one of the feeder narratives that helped get the Charlottesville thing happening was the aftermath of the Dylann Roof massacre. That was a pretext for beginning to take down Confederate monuments around the South. Can you talk a little bit about that as one of the things that some background for the attack on the Lee Monument in Charlottesville?
For me, it was that personally, it was a direct line from that to my involvement with Charlottesville, because I think it's very connected, because, you know, the Dylann Roof shooting was awful, but it immediately got connected to the Confederate flag for no really clear reason, other than there was an old photo of him with the flag. And Nikki Haley decided to, she catapulted herself into the national spotlight with this and got to be, you know, the hero for, you know, the New South and getting rid of, you know, she said it was for healing, which, you know, is ridiculous to say that you create healing by removing things that are important to a big part of the population. The flag had been an issue for decades, and Confederate monuments were being removed in other places, but it didn't really get, I think it just gained so much momentum, and it, you know, the people saw blood in the water, and there was a frenzy to get, they started attacking every monument they could. And that's why when I saw the Charlottesville rally, I was like, this is important, you know, somebody, because I was very frustrated that nobody was taking a strong stand about the monument removal. And just to see a bold statement saying this needs to stop, you know, that was, you know, I had a lot of hope for that.
Jason, can you tell us a bit about your connection with Charlottesville and the Lee Memorial, why this was an issue for you? One of the things that in the South, they would complain about the outside agitators coming into the South, you know, these students from Harvard and Yale coming into the South to agitate against segregation and so forth. And that phrase outside agitators was thrown around. And it's very ironic to me that the left now loves the globalist left, where there's no inside and outside and everybody is just human, etc. But suddenly they will start talking about people they don't like as outsiders. This is hilarious. You see this in debates about Ireland that I've been following on Twitter. Suddenly borders matter when globalists are getting schooled on Twitter by people in America. You know, if an Irish globalist gets schooled on Twitter by an American, suddenly borders matter. Of course, anybody can be Irish, but suddenly borders matter when their ox is gored. And there is this rhetoric about Unite the Right that, oh, this is outsiders coming in and disrupting our peaceful, loving community. Or another narrative I saw is that this is just a pretext for Nazis to march around and express hate. It has nothing to do with Southern heritage. Can you correct some of that? Because I think your book is valuable for presenting some of the background that refutes those kinds of talking points.
Yeah, I was born in Charlottesville, and part of the history of that city is that it's Thomas Jefferson's city. You know, his Monticello is there, his University of Virginia is there, and that's the university that I graduated from. And growing up in that area, and especially spending Christmases there, you know, you really felt that reverence for Jefferson and Jeffersonian values like free speech. So my idea of Charlottesville is that it was a very liberal city in the classical sense, you know, and there were organizations like the Thomas Jefferson Center for Free Expression that supposedly supported free speech. And I'd moved around a little bit. And when I came to live in Charlottesville as an adult, I saw it being transformed. A lot of it was by this, you know, vampire's den at the university, which seems to be a place where a lot of left-wing changes are happening in a lot of cities around the country. And there were just these radicals in City Hall. There was black supremacists and Jewish supremacists were the mayor and vice mayor. You had just adult children screaming and crying in the council chambers. You know, things had gotten out of control and they felt like they could shut people down and cancel people. And so I wasn't on board with that. You know, I was more of a Jefferson guy than a Lee guy, to be honest. But I loved Lee too, because the Lee Monument was right next to the library where I would go pick up books and I'd sit there in the park and read. And no one was paying any attention to that monument, including black people. It wasn't until these left-wing agitators, you know, the black supremacist Wes Bellamy, started telling people, oh, well, you know, you're just a pawn for the white supremacist if you're not angry about this monument, that people started getting worked up about it. And I didn't like that. And Wes Bellamy himself was an out-of-town agitator. He wasn't from Charlottesville. And he commented on his Twitter feed about how he hated seeing white people around town and, you know, things of that nature. So this is a radical who came in and wanted to sort of purge what he saw as the white supremacist elements of the city.
Yeah, this is an interesting phenomenon. There are monuments all over the South. And the monuments were put up in a time of reconciliation and healing to get past the wounds of the war. And the left today basically just wants to tear the bandages off and reopen these wounds as a way of destroying society. Ultimately, I think that's what it's about. There's no clear end game here. They just want to unleash chaos by unleashing hatred. I remember seeing Mark Potok, formerly of the SPLC, being interviewed and talking about a monument in some place, I think it was in Louisiana. And he says, this needs to come right down. And I just thought, you know, we need to take a page from King Charles II. At the end of the English Civil War, after the Restoration, Charles passed an act called the Act of Indemnity and Oblivion. And basically what it was, it was a amnesty for all the crimes that were committed during the Civil War, except for regicide and certain outrageous things like, you know, murder and rape. But all the things connected with the revolution, the interregnum, etc., that could be brought up in court in the future and serve as a cause for further unrest in the society. Those things needed to be forgotten. Those things needed to be amnestied. And amnesty, is literally forgetting. It comes from the same root as amnesia. We're going to forget about these things. We're going to let this pass. Because if we don't, we're simply not going to be able to live together. And we've gone through this period of civil war, and we don't want to reopen the civil war. And next to that act of indemnity was the act of oblivion. And this, I thought, was extraordinary. It criminalized those who wanted to reopen the wounds of the war. It said that this is simply not acceptable. And there was no talk about freedom of speech or anything like that. In order to live together and move forward, not only are certain crimes going to be forgotten, but in the future, if people try and use these past events as a pretext for stirring up trouble, they will be punished for that. And I thought, that's extraordinary. We honestly needed an act of oblivion, not just amnesties and shaking hands, Civil War veterans from North and South, things like that, these healing gestures. It really needed to have teeth. But of course, at the time in the 19th century, they couldn't have imagined the mentality of somebody like Mark Potok or an organization like Black Lives Matter that basically just want to use historical quote-unquote injustices to inflame and destroy contemporary society.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly couldn't have envisioned the demographic changes that have happened. And one thing that I see on Twitter all the time is people whose ancestors weren't here at the time of the Civil War, like people from parts of Asia and India and Africa, and they dress up in a Union outfit or something, and then they make jokes about Confederate tears and you're the losers. And the funny thing is like, you know, these guys are the same ones who are crying about slavery. So I thought you feel like losers should be held in contempt. What about the Native Americans? Didn't they lose? What about the slaves? They couldn't have won if they were turned into slaves. So they're just picking this fight to turn Confederates into the American Nazis so that they can banish their memory. And once we our memories and our heroes have been stolen, we are not far behind. Part of the book goes into an analysis of what it means when the statues are attacked. And there's a number of scholars who talk about how it is a symbolic representation of a living person. So when they are executing a statue of a white man, that is a mock execution of who they really want to be killing. And statues, you know, monuments have a very sacred place in human society.
And the way the Lee Monument was destroyed was very vicious, really, really vicious.
Yeah. They've been taking down monuments that are actually tombs and desecrating the bodies. And with this Lee Monument in particular, I have a chapter towards the end, which is about what they did to the Lee Monument, where they had a celebration. These anti-whites were drinking and hooting and hollering as they basically cut into the Lee Monument with buzz saws and melted it. And they were reveling in all of the similarities between the quote unquote death of that monument and the death of a real person.
Well, they're destroying us in effigy, and that's a prelude to destroying us in fact. So we're at 30 minutes. Folks, if you are out there in Radioland and you have questions for Jason, go to enterbestream.live. It's across the screen, at the bottom of the screen. Countercurrents without the hyphen. You can send our favorite kind of question, which is a question attached to a super chat, a donation. This is very important for us because it helps us keep Countercurrents on the air, basically, Countercurrents publishing. And right now, we have a matching grant. On Tuesday, we celebrated our 14th birthday, which is a long run, given a lot of projects in the quote-unquote movement will pop up and disappear within a year or two. So we've been around for 14 years. Not close to Jared Taylor. He's been around for 34, but still, we're proud of it, and we want to continue to be around for many years to come. Some generous donors put together a matching grant, $14,000, and we have already gotten through more than $12,000 of that matching grant. It's very gratifying, but anything that you give today will be doubled. That's an added incentive for helping out. So go to Entropy. You can also send questions and donations through Odyssey as well. And we would definitely like to use this opportunity for you to pick the brain of our author. I have a question for the panel, and I'll go first to Anne. Are there things that you think that Jason could have added to this book? Do you think there's stuff that was maybe overlooked or could be emphasized? It's a big book, but are there things that you would like to have seen more of, or maybe for in the future you'd like to see discussed?
Well, yes, I don't feel like the book was missing anything, but that said, there's so much to say about Charlottesville. I know when I was writing my book, it was very hard. I got it down to 400 pages, but it could have been, you know, five times as long because there's so much information that would be good to compile. But one thing I think would be really good for the future would be some in-depth analysis of the legal fallout, the criminal and civil cases, which your listeners probably know are still ongoing. There's many still ongoing because that has been a big part of the Charlottesville story. You know, that there's still people being arrested 7 years later, that there's still lawsuits that are pending, free speech lawsuits or whatever. And that's got an ongoing importance. So I think that's something that should be explored more in the future.
Yeah. Roger, do you have any thoughts about things that you'd like to see added to that you think could have been added to the book or maybe should be dealt with in the future?
A second edition. Yes, there it would be good to see a second edition whenever and if ever the legal fallout ends. and we can look back at this with a little more perspective. That's what I thought when I was reading Ann Smith's book a few years ago, in fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jason, let me ask you, are you planning to continue writing about this or have you decided you've gotten it off your chest and you want to move on to other topics? Will there be a second edition? Will you be, I kind of know the answer to this because you've been following the trials of the Tiki Torch marchers, Jacob Dix, you've been commenting on that. So this is a story that is ongoing. And I hope that you know, maybe it would be good if you could write more on these legal cases after they have all been wrapped up. Just the sheer number of people who have been caught in the dragnet, the sheer number of people who've had their lives turned upside down, who have been harassed, who have been pauperized, and the amount of money and people who are working to wreck people's lives. It's maybe we shouldn't talk about this. It's so discouraging, but it is a monstrous injustice. It's an industry now. It's not a cottage industry. It's an industry of attacking and harming these people. When do you think it's going to end?
There's no telling, but as far as the criminal stuff, I think that the Tiki stuff is the last gasp of that. And it's just happening because this Soros funded prosecutor, Jim Hinchley, had promised that if he was elected, that he would prosecute these people. And I don't think they're necessarily on strong legal footing to do these cases, but it's a political matter rather than a legal one. And yeah, I actually mentioned most of the cases in the book, although clearly some of them haven't been finished yet. And I'm still writing articles. My most recent Countercurrents article was about the Jacob Dix trial. So my articles are sort of continuation of what I talked about in the book. But I do want to talk about other things as well. I'd like to write a second book, Strategy and Tactics, because I would like to have some impact on the future and not just dwell on the past forever. But I do think that it's important to understand the past. And as the saying goes, he who controls the past controls the present. He who controls the present controls the future. So it's all connected.
Yes, we have a couple questions that have come in. I would like to thank a few people. A couple of these have hung around since Tuesday, I think. Through Pale Obfuscation sends $50. Thank you very much. And says, happy birthday, Countercurrents. Thank you. Mart has sent in $12.75. Thank you very much. We will get your order out. I guess it's a book order. 617 Squadron's Dog has sent $5. He wants to talk about G.K. Chesterton. I want to save that for the next stream because that's a little off topic. But yeah, let's talk about Chesterton in the future. Chesterton and Belloc. Are there any articles on Chesterton at Countercurrents? I think we have something where Anthony Ludovici mentions briefly his interactions with Chesterton. It's from his autobiography. So that might be on the website. ABC writes in with $10. Thank you very much. He says, unite the right is a notion that the anti-white American system fears the most. In the American-dominated Europe, in recent EU elections, the far right won about 20% of the votes, but their impact will be limited because of disunity and inside quarrels. How would you solve this cat herding problem? Jason, how do we solve the problem of pettiness, infighting, cat herding, and stuff like that? Well, how do we unite the right?
It's a major problem, and that's why I'm saying that people have to read this book in order to have a basic literacy in how to organize in white nationalism, because there was, despite the name of the event being Unite the Right, there was so much disunity and infighting. And you get to understand some of the common personality types that kind of tend to pop up in radical politics, the narcissism, the egomania. It just repeats itself ad nauseum. So the first thing is just to be aware of what you're getting into, because I wasn't aware of what I was getting into. I was very idealistic and naive in 2017, and I got clobbered over the head for it. I was, in my mind, very innocent, and people just totally took advantage of that and steamrolled me. But I think you have to have a defined set of principles and a plan. There's a lot of infighting that happens because there's no plan. People are just out there trying to get attention for themselves. They're just saying whatever they can to increase their social media engagement in their clout, getting more donations, blah, blah, blah. But nobody really has a plan to win. It's just to increase their own platforms. So I think that the first thing to do is to have a definite strategy that you can convince people of. And then you stick to that strategy. It's that simple. You know, everything else is a deviation from that. But people do have to sort of grow up a little bit. Radical politics attracts a lot of deviant personalities, a lot of people who do not fit into society very well. And if you are going to organize, if you're going to get the people to get along with one another, you have to be somebody who can let their ego go, who can not react with anger immediately and say something inflammatory. And it's tough for everybody, even professional politicians, when they're constantly being attacked in personal ways 24/7. You're always connected to the internet. There's always somebody coming after you. But you got to learn to let that stuff go and to just to be the bigger man or woman. That's the way that it's got to be.
Yeah, that's good advice. I do think that we have to be attentive to certain personality disorders, signs of personality disorders, and steer clear of people who show these strong narcissistic vibes. People who are clearly in it for very personal reasons that might not have anything to do with actually advancing a cause bigger than themselves. People like that always disappoint. And just being attentive to the signs of that, I think, is hugely important. And yeah, I also think having an actual common goal is a huge way of overcoming infighting, because people think, okay, we're making progress on something. Let's see how we can pull together. And sometimes it's hard to provide those things. Sometimes they just have to pop up and grab everybody's attention. I'm thinking of 2015 when Trump threw his hat in the ring. That was a game-changing thing. And a lot of people on the right united around that. And I guess in a way, the Unite the Right rally was an attempt to come up with another unifying force once Trump was in office and already disappointing us a great deal.
It ought to be emphasized that the original idea of Unite the Right was to bring the alt-right together with the alt-light, as Jason says. And that fell apart almost immediately, I believe, didn't it?
Well, before the rally actually happened, can you give us some background on that? That is actually kind of interesting. And it sort of foreshadowed all the falling out and disavowing and stuff that came after the rally.
Well, the reason it was called Unite the Right is because I saw the Republican Party as predominantly white. It is predominantly white. They care about a lot of the same issues, illegal immigration. And the only drawback that I saw was that they weren't willing to explicitly stand up for white people. It was all this coded stuff, you know, nothing explicit. And then you had the alt-right, which was definitely willing to explicitly stand up for white people. But then they also had all kinds of other issues that were off-putting to mainstream conservatives. You know, I'm much more radical than I was in 2017. I criticize Jewish power a lot more now than I did then. But at the time, I was like, this is a third rail. I don't want to touch this. This is about white identity. It's not against anybody else. I wanted to keep it focused in the middle between the extreme and the moderate on, we can unite on the shared principle that it's okay to be white, that there's nothing wrong with our history, that we can defend our history and stand up for ourselves. And so you had the alt-light and the MAGA Republicans being the more moderate people. And I invited some of them. I invited Gavin McInnes, and I invited base stickman Kyle Chapman and some other folks. And none of them wanted to show up on the same stage with Richard Spencer, basically. You know, they felt like it was too extreme. And that was one of the first real wake-up calls for me in how far free speech principles have fallen, is that all these guys who, you know, might publicly claim to care about free speech, you know, they didn't want to go to a free speech event with people who say things that they might agree with in private, but they don't want to be associated with publicly.
Mm-hmm.
I keep thinking about the Churchill quote. I think it's Churchill about, you appeasement is feeding a crocodile, hoping it eats you last. And that's what these people are doing. And that's what I was saying earlier. If you don't, you know, put your foot down and say, no, free speech is for everyone, you know, I don't care if you like these people or not, then it's going to keep encroaching. And these disavowals were, you know, appeasement. And now these same people have been eaten by that crocodile. And so it's such an important thing, you know, and it got all the way to the president. And so you have to stand on the principle. And these people weren't really brave enough to do that. And, you know, when you're talking about unity, that, I mean, you've got to be able to stand up for the principles, whether you like the other people or not.
Absolutely. I have a question here from a longtime reader, Mary Lou. She wants to know, Jason, what are some of the reactions to your book so far? I know it's just newly out, but there have been reviews. I'm sure you've gotten some private reactions. Is it gratifying?
Yeah, I mean, well, it is so new that not everybody has had a chance to read through it yet. But, you know, I'm so grateful for Ann and Roger's reviews, and for you, Greg, posting them on Countercurrents. And, you know, I everything has been positive to me, you know, as far as the people who follow me on social media. They've been showing me pictures of themselves reading the book, and everybody's just shocked. Like, I can't believe how good this is. I can't believe how professional it is. I love the photos. We've got like all kinds of photos, both famous photos from Unite the Right, as well as rare photos, some never before released, of like drone footage that we had to buy. We had to spend a little bit of money so you could see like the crowd in the park during the event. And stuff that I had on my phone from not just August 12th, but the first torch demonstration on May 13th, and lots of other stuff. I've got every single one of the speakers represented in a photograph. Antifa, we've got stuff from all of the other demonstrations that happened that year that led up to Charlottesville, whether that's the Battle of Berkeley, the Battle of New Orleans, the Washington DC Trump inauguration riots. So yeah, everybody has been really impressed by the amount of research, how easy it is to pull up any videos, any primary source documents. You know, I've got emails from the police and everything. And all you got to do is just hover your phone over a QR code, and you get like all of the secret documents that I was able to access through my civil lawsuits and Freedom of Information Act requests.
Yeah, that's a great feature. It's something that I hope other books will start doing. Why have footnotes, right, when you can just, you know, literally put your phone next to the page and you can access all kinds of online documentation? I think that's extremely useful. And it's far better than trying to type out a URL, squinting at the bottom of a page to try and type out a URL, or find these things with search engines, which are astonishingly bad now. With each passing day, I find fewer and fewer things just by doing Google searches. It's so clogged up with censorship and also sponsored content. So you've done a great work.
Regards to something like Charlottesville, the censorship, I mean, it started the day after and it's been, you know, consistent. So that's why I thought that parts of this book were really valuable, because it's preserving things that it's going to be next to impossible to find online.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I brought a lot of things back from the dead. I mean, there's so many videos. Anne is right that YouTube takes down, and they're not even really political. They're just actual video of the event. And the fact that they're taking that down is really Orwellian in the most frightening sense. And even as I'm writing the book, you know, tweets are being taken down, news articles are being taken down. So this book was also an archival project. So I was able to archive a lot of websites, links, social media posts, so that they can never be taken down from the public square. I re-uploaded documents onto my personal website so that I'm in control of their distribution. No one else can just decide to take that down. I re-uploaded videos to BitChute. So you have things like, you know, whenever a big event happens, people will refer to some video or tweet like, remember that, but it's been deleted and no one can find it anymore. An example of that is the left-wing reporter Taylor Lorenz, who has written for The Hill and Huffington Post. After the James Field car incident, she put out a series of tweets basically corroborating some of the arguments that are made in his defense, that a lot of the police are saying he was just scared, his car was under attack. So I meticulously went through the searches and I found the URL to that dead link that she deleted. I found the archive and I put it there in the book for everybody to utilize if they want to.
That's great. One of our readers, again, a longtime reader, Sutton, has written in, and he just wants to know, Jason, how can people buy the book? And are there things that people can do to promote it?
Well, it is available on Amazon, but the best place to buy it is on the website for my publishing company, Dissident Press. That's dissident.press, dissident.press. And you can also find the link to that on my social media. If you look up at The Mad Dimension on Twitter or search Jason Kessler, hopefully I'm not shadow banned. They're in my profile on my Twitter, also on my Gab and my Telegram. You're going to find the link to Dissident Press. It's also at my website, jasonkessler.us. If you want to promote it, the best thing you can do is share the links on forums, talk to people about the book, share your experience, share this video around to people, and follow us on social media. Dissident Press has a Twitter account and we follow everybody back. So if you're looking to increase your followers a little bit, you'll get one free follower right away by following us on social media.
That is great. One of our readers, Lovecraft's Cat, wants to know, would you do it over again, given all that's happened? If you could go back in time, would you just pass up on this opportunity to organize this rally?
Well, obviously, it was very painful. But I mean, you know, people say that about relationships, too. You know, people get married and then they are in love with somebody and then they divorce and they feel an enormous amount of pain. And they're like, God, I wish that I could take it back. But I don't wish that I could take it back, actually, because as painful as it was, it made me who I am today. I am an enormously stronger person today for what I went through in Charlottesville, because all of these people doubted me and they all wanted to talk trash about me. And, you know, it caused me to move out of Charlottesville, which was a dead end for me. I started a business because these people were suing me and I didn't have enough money to hire an attorney. So, wow, I became a small business owner. And now because of this experience, you know, I'm an author. So, you know, a lot of good things have come from it. People saw me in Charlottesville and I'm looking kind of fat and out of shape. All right, I'm going to get in shape because fuck you. You can't, you know, define me. I'm going to define myself. And, you know, just I found the whole process of, you know, being destroyed and rebuilding myself to be enormously helpful to who I am today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another thing is that obviously some terrible things happened because of this. You know, Heather Heyer died. James Fields' life has been ruined. People have been doxxed. People have killed themselves even. There's no suggestion here, I think, in this questioner that you are in any way responsible for that. Because, well, you were within your rights. You were within your rights to do this. And the terrible things that have happened were done to you and the other people who suffered by their enemies. I fervently believe that everything is on the city of Charlottesville. They were the ones who allowed this to spin out of control. They are the ones who are responsible for Heather Heyer's death, for James Fields, and of course, then he was just ridiculously railroaded, and so on and so forth. There are massive forces of industrial scale evil that have been brought to bear against you and against everybody who participated in that protest. And a lot of people crumbled, and you didn't. You came out stronger. And I do think that's very, very impressive.
Thank you. And I'd like to respond to the impact that it's had on other people, because I mostly answered the question about myself. But certainly, yes, a lot of people other than me have paid heavy costs. And there's two things to that. First of all, yes, I think that the evidence that I put in this book shows beyond a shadow of a doubt that this was something that was done to us. This was not something that any of the organizers, any of the attendees could have possibly planned for. We had constitutional rights. We tried to do things by the law. We were represented by the ACLU in federal court. The record in the book will show that I repeatedly went to the heads of the Charlottesville government and told them what was going to happen. I said, we're afraid that the police are going to stand down like they did in Berkeley, California earlier this year, that we're afraid that the Antifa and BLM are going to clog the path outside the venue and attack people, and it's going to lead to a riot. And who could have guessed that these people would hate us so much and they would be so irresponsible that they would look at that and say, we're going to be less responsible than Jason Kessler. We're going to intentionally provoke a riot to not only destroy him, but to try and blame it all on this alt-right movement and blame it all on Donald Trump. And they've found that was a winning formula for them. That's why they did it at January 6th. But also, you know, let's be real here. I mean, whenever you're talking about the changing of a guard between one political ideology and another in power, they don't just give that away. You know, so I really take umbrage at people who think that they're just going to sit on the internet and make snarky comments and suddenly everything is going to fall into their lap. You think that happened with Julius Caesar? Do you think that happened with Hitler? Do you think that happened with Alexander the Great? Or do you think men went into the field and lost their arms, were disemboweled, they died? So in modern political warfare, which is more political than anything, you have political prisoners. It's happening in Russia. It happens in Ukraine. It happens in China. It happens in Europe, where people are jailed for denying the Holocaust, which is a political view, which is protected here in the United States. So people need to grow up a little bit and honor the people who sacrificed when they went to Charlottesville and not diminish it and say, oh, they were just stupid. No, they paid a price that some people don't have the guts to pay.
Yeah, that's really well said. We are coming up on an hour. I'd like to keep this at an hour or a little bit more, just so more people will listen to it. Because when people see a two-hour stream, the cursor hovers a bit before they think, well, I'm going to click on this and listen to it. And I really want this to have as big an audience as possible. So I want to go to Anne first and then to Roger and just ask for some final thoughts about the book. And would you recommend to people out there to buy and read this book?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, people still talk about Charlottesville every single day. And, you know, there's so much misinformation and lack of information. So, I mean, anyone who wants to know the truth about this event that is still in our part of our public debate every day should want to hear from the organizer and the person that has the most inside information.
Great. Roger, what are your thoughts? Do you recommend this book? What are your final? What's your final word?
Yes, I certainly do. My final word is that they're out of stock at Amazon. I just checked, so there's another good reason to buy directly from Jason at Dissident Press.
That's great.
Not to give any tips to Jeff Bezos.
Right. Well, Jason, let's wrap up with a few final thoughts from you, and then I'll again we'll go around and get information on how people can follow Anne and Roger's work. But what are some final thoughts from you about this?
Sure. So if people want to learn more about the book, go to dissident.press and there's a description of the book. There's also two videos, one of which is essentially like a trailer for the documentary of Charlottesville, which hopefully we'll see one day, which hasn't come out yet. And this was part of the production budget for this book, is we created, a pastiche of a bunch of different clips related to the Charlottesville event with dramatic music and titles and everything like that. So that's a fun way for you to get excited about the book and about the narrative, because this is an action-packed book. You know, I mean, it's almost got as much action as if it was like a war movie because of all the violence we had to endure at this event. And follow on social media, and as you're reading it, you know, share your thoughts with me, because I think that you're really going to love this book. It's a beautiful book, both in paperback and hardcover. You can get signed and unsigned editions of it, and it really looks good on your shelf. I've got a copy of the paperback right here. This is what it looks like, and you know, you can see lots of photos and stuff in there. There you go.
Great. Well, how do people follow your ongoing work?
The best place is to go to jasonkessler.us, because I publish all of my articles there that link to Countercurrents, VDare, wherever. And also on my Twitter. My Twitter's been growing like crazy since Elon Musk took whatever algorithmic suppression was on there. I'm getting some monster tweets. So seems to be a pretty happening place, and people are enjoying the content that I'm putting out there. And I'm also on Telegram, where sometimes I'll post longer stuff or more personal stuff for like the super fans who want more content from me than I even put up on Twitter.
Wonderful. And how do people follow your work?
Well, my books are my Charlottesville book and my Robert E. Lee for Children book are published through ShotwellPublishing.com. I write for VDare and for Countercurrents. I do have a Twitter I don't use too much. I just recently got back on, Early Annie SC, but that would be the places for me.
I really enjoy your Twitter account. So
thank you.
Folks, give her a follow. You have great takes on things, so I appreciate that. Roger, how do people follow your work, and what's coming up in the near future?
I'm not on Twitter, but I am on Gab, and I write a lot for Countercurrents and American Renaissance.
Wonderful. And you are bringing out something soon from the IHR as well, you mentioned.
Oh, that's right. Just an essay at the Institute for Historical Review website. I've been doing done a couple of pieces for Mark recently.
Wonderful
books there.
Well, folks, we've had a really nice audience, and I'm sure many, many hundreds and thousands of people eventually will listen to this in replays. I want to thank Jason, Anne, and Roger for joining us. I want to thank the super chatters and the moderators, everybody who has been with us in the stream. It's been a very moderate group of people. Great, great comments. A nice civil feel. So we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. We will be doing a book club next month again. The topic is to be announced. And so stay tuned for that. And in the meantime, keep reading Countercurrents. Thank you.